My name is Bernd. This morning I walked over from Beginner's Mind Temple, or as it's sometimes called, San Francisco Zen Center. But sitting here this morning, I thought, it sounds as if there was only one Zen Center. So it was good for me to drop this idea by walking over here to Hartford Street Zen Center. I live at Zen Center, I have a job at Zen Center, practice at Zen Center. My day job, so to speak, is I'm guest manager, conference manager. So the way I see it, I take care of people in this way. But I'm also what we call a practice leader. So often before all the activity of the day starts, early in the morning, I meet with people. We meet. We try to meet intimately. And these last couple of weeks, I want to share this here. I heard a lot. Suffering is very deep. There's certainly joy in human life, but lately I felt there's deep darkness. Maybe it's almost cliche that a German says that. So, seeing this, I asked myself, so what is it that encourages me? Because only if I know that, I feel, can I be there for others and encourage them and take care of them? So, so I looked into that again, and it makes me say here this morning that I trust Zazen. And I think what I trust is bringing awareness to our experience, whether it's joyful or painful. And my faith is that actually the human condition, the human mind can change, can transform. But I also think we have to have lots of patience. So to trust Zazen, for me, it means to become still in the ever-changing stream of human experience, to become completely still. Still, receptive, I would say, receiving, and curious. And then, in the stillness, and with this naturally curious mind, to simply ask, oh, what is this? What is this? And then I think, in the stillness of Zazen, we are actually being taught about the nature of our life. And I also think when we're really open to be taught, we might find out, perhaps, that teachings of Buddhism, teachings of Zen, are not different from what life itself has to teach us. So, for example, Yunmen, he was a Chinese Zen teacher who lived in the 9th century. One time, on an occasion meeting with his students, he was asked, what is the place where all the Buddhas come from? What is the place where all the Buddhas come from? And the answer he gave was, next question. Next question. I don't know. I hope you simply understand. I hope you understand the simplicity of this. Simply having an open mind, curious mind, an inquiring mind. I'd like to add a mind that's not bound by any concept, a mind that's not bound by any teachings, Buddhist or non-Buddhist. This is actually the place where you, as Buddha, come from. Simple, curious, open mind. It's a mind where you, where we receive being Buddha. It's also the mind where we express being Buddha. So someone who expressed being Buddha right here in this place was, of course, Issan Dorsey. And he did so in his own and unique way. I want to say a few words about my relationship with Hartford Street Zen Center. I first came here in the fall of 1994. I had just arrived from Germany to actually study with Judith Butler, who's a queer philosopher teaching at UC Berkeley. But more and more I was drawn to come here. I think at that point I was intrigued by something that I simply had not seen in my practice in Germany. And what I saw was a direct and, to me, very meaningful response of practitioners to the suffering in their community, suffering called AIDS. So for quite a while, I sat in the Zendo. I went through training as a hospice volunteer. One of the first people I met in America is Jennifer. Was here. I kind of hung out with the people who came here to die. And I tried to respond to their needs. Then I came across David Schneider's biography of Issan, Street Zen. And upon reading it, I felt that this would actually be a very important book to have in Germany. Two things. I thought at that time, 1995, that it would be important to have Issan's story be available in German as an inspiration for practitioners. Because at least as I saw it at that point, my limited view, practitioners in Germany were not so engaged in, let's say, carrying their practice from the cushion into the social realm. But I also thought that David's book could be an inspiration for queer people, as it showed that we didn't have to sever our ties with our spiritual longings or spiritual traditions in order to simply be who we are. So I suggested the book to the handful of Buddhist and queer publishers that existed in Germany at that time. And to this day, I think that the response was pretty interesting. There were maybe three Buddhist publishers. Two of them rejected the book because it explicitly dealt with sexuality and sex. Now, queer publishers, on the other hand, rejected the book because it was about religion. And religion, at that point, in gay German culture, was really seen by most people as the enemy. Things have changed since then. And I also sit here to say that I think things have changed also a little bit because Street Zen finally came out in German language. Because in 1996, I spoke to Ursula Richard. She was the editor of Suzuki Roshi's Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind in German. And she simply had the open mind and the courage to publish Street Zen, and she really had the courage to allow me to translate it. So in this way, I feel I entered a brief phase in my life, lasted 6 months, where I lived very intimately with Issa. I entered his life, of course. It was the life as David Schneider saw it. So, and it was a very wonderful time for me because as a German, I could actually be here in San Francisco and live with and translate this book. But of course, it's work. So sometimes when I felt stuck in translating, I actually biked through the city and I visited various locations of Issan's life. One time I even went into the clubs in North Beach, which had been part of the gay scene in Issan's younger days, places where he had performed, as most of you know. Well, when I visited them, they had transformed into, what's a good word? Let's see, establishments that claimed to cater to the sexual needs of straight men. This is how things change, slowly. So, now I jump. 15 years later, this last May, Ursula Richard, German editor of Street Zen, came to Zen Center and practiced with us for 4 weeks. She had just published a new edition in German of the book. And she also told me about a one-man show on the life of Issan, which had just opened in Berlin. You can actually watch excerpts on YouTube if you're interested. So one night, she and I came to Hartford Street to sit. It was a coincidence. There was the monthly memorial for Issa. And after the ceremony, I introduced Ursula to people sitting. Some of you are here. And before I left, Reverend Mule kindly invited me to come here and talk. So here I am. So I saw and still see Issa as this man who practiced Zazen, as a man who cultivated the stillness at the core of a very active, engaged, and I guess at times flamboyant life. And I also have this take on Issa, which is simply my take, that he, without changing who he was, in this stillness, he found out that he was Buddha. And he encouraged others to be Buddha. I think it is about Issa that Suzuki Roshi could have said what he said when he said, just to be yourself is enough. So, just to be yourself is enough. Allow me to say a little bit about this. I think, as with many, let's say, seemingly simple statements by Suzuki Roshi, this teaching, just to be yourself is enough, it's kind of enigmatic. It's more of a question, an exploration, I think, than a statement. Because could just to be yourself possibly mean to just follow our selfish tendencies? To just express our karmic patterns as they are? Didn't most of us come to practice because we more or less knew that something was off with that approach to life? And being yourself, don't we want to go beyond ourselves? Thinking about this, I asked myself, could Suzuki Roshi possibly mean that I, in my anxieties, my feeling of lack, my sense of fragmentation, that I am enough just like that? Is this really all there is? Then where do all the Buddhas come from? Next question. So I want to say, at this point in my life and practice, I feel just to be oneself, certainly is not easy. I think, for example, and that's just one point, that being oneself is based in an understanding that we have no control over how our self-expression is received. example, some of you might like what I have to say, others certainly will not. And it is true, I can and I try to make every effort to express myself clearly, kindly, and compassionately. But in the end, I think there's no control I have over your response, and I even don't want to. So, for example, if I wish to please all of you, I think I could not be myself. I would need to bend and strategize, and that's clear. This is certainly not what being yourself means. For example, I think when Isan opened this temple for people living with AIDS and people dying from AIDS-related symptoms, he was just himself. But as some of you know, some of the residents who lived here actually did not like this and left. So hopefully people who left were just themselves too. I feel Suzuki Roshi's statement has an echo in the distant past. Dungshan is considered one of the founders of this tradition of Soto Zen practice in the 9th century China. At one time, he was about to leave his longtime teacher, Yunyan, and he asked him, "After I leave here, what can I actually say about you?" And Yunyan, after pausing for a moment, said, "Just this person." So playfully, I think that Suzuki Roshi might have thought of Yunyan's "just this person" when he said, "Just to be yourself is enough." And I also think that Isan, who literally embraced his dying brothers on their deathbeds, right here in this building, he also transmitted the teaching of just this person in this way. So, some of you might know, and that becomes pretty interesting for me, just this person is actually a phrase that people in ancient China used before a judge to confess their guilt. So on a certain level, just this person means, yes, I'm guilty. It's a confession. So again, it's a tricky phrase. I think it helps us to open up. So it certainly can mean, oh, just be yourself, as in, oh, just follow your cravings, which I still feel is something that mainstream culture suggests to us. And I think it suggests this to us to distract us from seeing and bringing awareness to our deep estrangement from ourselves and others. So I think what I like to propose to you is that when Yunmen says, just this person, Suzuki Roshi declares, just to be yourself is enough. When Issan is holding hands with people throughout life and death, that all these expressions arose out of a deep probing look into the nature of human life. Coming back to the beginning, I would say practicing zazen, being completely still. Reality actually taught these people that as human beings, in some strange way, we are actually not in accord with reality. However, in opening up, in a strange way, reality actually can show this to us. I find this very miraculous. So our crime, so to speak, just this person, the crime which we confess and express and make public, maybe, by saying just this person, actually is that we take for reality what is not real. We tend to think that we are separate and, in a way, permanent beings. While in truth, this is not the case. And maybe we could say there's nothing wrong with that. But I think as long as we do not see this discrepancy between what we think we are and what we actually are, as long as we are kind of stuck there, we are not enough for ourselves, others are not enough for us, we don't have enough, we don't think we get enough. Enough is not enough. In short, we are beings of lack. I'm a little hesitant to say this, but I do want to say it. It comes from my memory of how it was here for me 15 years ago. So in this house in which so many people have died, I would also like to say, if we remain in this illusion, death could also be a time of deep regret. However, in a mysterious way, just seeing this, just seeing, opening up to our illusion, pacifies us. Basically, I think it pacifies us because we directly understand that there's nothing out there anymore that we could grasp to fill our lack. And I think that's point over and over when we are open to receive the teaching, just to be yourself is enough. Because just yourself, in a way, is all there is. So, So, interestingly to me, the path to opening up to this vision is to accept who we are right now, right here. I think there's no other way. To accept completely how we experience our life and the lives of others, and yet to not get stuck there. So it is exactly the person we are right now, the person of lack, who sits zazen and then sinks deeper and deeper, opens up, sinks into stillness. And then I think when we no longer resist being who in truth we are being taught. Once again, I feel that's an important point, at least for me. Resistance to zazen naturally arises. But bringing awareness to resistance and opening up to resistance, it will dissolve and we open up. So there's nothing wrong with resistance. And then we're being taught who in truth we are. And one way to express what we are being taught is to simply say, just this person. But of course, even for Dungshan, it was not easy to open up to his master's teaching. As story goes, for many years he wandered from place to place, let's say, meditating on these words, reflecting about them, and taking them into his meditation. Until one day, as the story goes, when he crossed a stream and he saw his shadow on the surface of the water, at that moment he opened up. So for a while I've wondered about the significance of Dungshan seeing his shadow, seeing his own figure on the surface of the water as, let's say, the trigger for what is called his enlightenment. And I would suggest that in the projection of his shadow onto the streaming water, he simply saw directly that there is no fixed, permanent self within the stream of experience. In brief, he was enlightened about delusion. And seeing that, was my take on it, he burst open into freedom. And then he composed a poem, and it has come down to us. So here it is. Don't seek outside, or you will be estranged from yourself. I now go on alone. Everywhere I go, I encounter it. I'm not it, but it is me. One must understand in this way to merge with things as they are. So I said what I said in my wish for all of you to burst open into freedom. Thank you very much. I didn't bring a watch.
Will you take questions?
Do we have time for that?
Yeah.
I didn't know the biographical background that you studied with Judith Butler, but I was wondering if you could talk more about your transition from Western philosophy to Eastern philosophy, because I think you kind of, I saw a little twitch when you said Judith Butler, that transition from Western to Eastern philosophy, I had that myself studying Nietzsche, and I was reading Ecce Homo, and your talk just totally, it's, you know, Ecce Homo means hear a man, and you know, he's trying to defeat the ideologues of German philosophy, but there's a part of Ecce Homo where he talks a little bit about Zen Buddhism, or not Buddhism, Zen Buddhism, Buddhism, and he says, you know, we're getting to this point where, and with the yay-saying and eternal return, that we can do basically what Buddhism has been doing. But by saying that, he's also saying that Buddhism was always pure from this kind of corrupting ideology surplus in Western philosophy. And I wonder if that's not so much a comparison of the two histories, but the way that they record knowledge. So I think in Western philosophy, you know, there's so much emphasis on a text, and it comes like through generations, and you have a specific timestamp on it. And, whereas in Buddhism, I think, you know, it's much more a dialogue between a multitude of different sources. So when you say, like, where is the Buddha? Next question. I was also wondering if you might have some kind of feedback on that.
So you bring up a lot. Thank you very much. So we can talk about this for a long time. So let's say what I find important. You asked me about my transition from Western philosophy to Buddhism. First of all, and you can know this, my take on my life is I was never in Western philosophy, and I also don't think that for me I would describe this unfolding of my own way as a transition. I would describe it as a dialogue. So maybe for people who are not so familiar with that, Judith Butler is somebody who I still very deeply appreciate, because she is a woman who took a deep probing look into, let's say, how we construct our identities. Even the stuff of which we think that it is naturally so. Yet she says, This is deeply a mental construction. In other words, we make it, we construct it. However, where it came too short for me, and I can say this now very clearly, is that as most of Western thought, she confines her analysis to the social and political realm. And what I think is the great thing of Buddhism is that it, in part, talks about something that I feel is not only absent in the way we usually talk, is not only absent in the social discourse, but is even a taboo, which is that we are actually cosmic beings. And I feel it right now. Saying that, I feel a little hesitation. That we are maybe small beings in the grand unfolding of things, and that miraculously, as these small beings, we can open up. And that also, basically, I see Zen practice as, in part, as a practice of mysticism. And there, I feel, in my understanding, Buddhist practice actually goes beyond. And I'm interested in this going beyond. Yet, I still find certain, analysis of queer and feminist thinking and others who maybe don't identify in this way very helpful in a cultural exchange, in fostering a dialogue between what we could call Buddhism and what we could call Western philosophy. Maybe that's enough for now. Yes, please.
Thank you very much for your talk. I'm very moved by it. and I wonder about something that you sort of referred to repeatedly, which is that if we think that just being ourselves is enough, that somehow is licensed to just run amok with our cravings and our delusions. And my hope is that there is a way that we can completely be ourselves in a skillful way and radically embrace our demons and our delusions and not push them away or somehow judge them ourselves as wrong. And yet to also call on the other parts of ourselves that are more transcendent, maybe, I don't know if that's the right word. And if we're completely ourselves, then we have all of those parts and we can move forward in a skillful way without doing harm and without changing who we are and who we're not enough. I'm wondering if you have a perspective on that.
Thank you. Well, on the one hand, I feel I tried to express my perspective on that this morning. So I don't know what else I have to add. I would say, also thinking of the question you just brought up, I would say as practitioners, it's maybe good to see that, let's say, the idea of just following our impulses as leading to freedom and happiness is an ideology. I actually think, and of course I tried this, and I still tried this in my life, so it's a process, but I feel more and more I can see that it leads to the opposite. It is actually not an expression of what I think Suzuki Roshi means by saying just to be yourself is enough. This is actually the opposite. However, the way to enter this vision, I think, as an embodied process of practice is to be completely open to our cravings, longings, to what I call our feeling of lack, to what maybe others call our demons, our shadow sides, to not reject and to not indulge. And that's how I see it, to be upright in the middle of these phenomena and experiences, and to then sink, that's my word. And then I think we will be taught what just to be yourself actually means.
Thank you.
Jennifer.
I keep remembering that time, speaking of just being yourself, that we were in Reb's koan class, and we were doing the koan about the cypress tree in the yard, and you got kicked out, or you left, you went out, and then I followed, and Clay and a few other people, we were all out in the darkness by this big tree. When we went back into the class, our places had been filled in by other people. Not much more to say on that, but do you remember why you stood and left?
But the beautiful thing about meeting this way is that I always say my friends remember my life much better. So Jennifer refers to a class at Green Gulch Farm for a long time. Now I feel I have been intimately studying with Tenshin Reb Anderson at Green Gulch. I feel I received great gifts, including this one. We studied Book of Serenity, ancient Chinese collection of koans. What I remember is that this specific koan, Reb basically said, "So, what's your take?" And as I was in those days, I raised my hand and I said, "I think it expresses a warning about koan study." And then he said, "I think you better leave this room now."
That's right.
And the koan simply, I don't remember these things, but simply was practitioner bringing up a very philosophical statement,
yeah,
and then a question, and then the Zen teacher says, "The cypress tree in the yard." And I left, and I opened up to the smells, and I embraced the big, I don't even know if they were cypress trees, but
redwoods.
And I was very much at peace, but I also know that other people were not. So that was an instance of seeing something that I also tried to say. We have no control over how our self-expression is received and what might happen, but I feel we can, in this world of entanglement, as we do now, we can open up to it and see, for example, that sometimes we have very different takes on what's going on, and then hopefully together let go of all of them. That's my wish. Okay.
Unless there's one more desperate question.
I'm very grateful for, as I see it, all of you inviting me to come here this morning. So thank you very much.